When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from the Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis.
Amy Winehouse died at the age of 27, and she lived a life full of opportunities that she both seized and missed. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 18 would be the age she was when she first stumbled onto a Monday night music scene that would change her life, shape her career, and keep certain bad habits within reach. Another one would be the number of years she would string along a dream-come-true collaborator as he waited in vain for her to contribute to a tribute album in his honor. One more would be the number of loyal longtime collaborators who would unwittingly find himself on the receiving end of an early morning social media flame war. Yet another one would be the number of pounds and millions that she would be offered to play a private 40-minute show for an anonymous Russian oligarch. Four more would be the number of hours past midnight when Amy's new flame would be ambushed by the press, photographed walking hand in hand with his ex-girlfriend. And two would be the number of distinct paths she could choose to take as her life stared down a very clear set of crossroads, all totaling 27. On this, our seventh episode of season four, Bad Habits, An Anonymous Russian Oligarch, Flame Wars, and Amy Winehouse. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. The DJ could feel the promoter eyeing him as he set up his gear. He knew the guy wanted to come over and talk to him. He tried to sneak a furtive glance, but the promoter locked eyes. Shit. Come on, man. Don't do it. Don't hassle me. The DJ had spent more nights absorbing London nightlife than he could remember. He was there. He was always there. He watched bands make a bloody racket. DJs spinning their siren's web, dance floors packed with sweaty bodies. Now, on this night, the tables were turned. He was the one up on stage, preparing to play his own set. And of course, just as luck, this promoter was ready to pounce. As the DJ finished arranging his decks and plugging in his gear, the promoter finally approached and handed him a list. Right, there it was. A list of records and artists he shouldn't play. The club was worried he would spin something the audience didn't want to hear, worried that he would clear the dance floor. But Errol Alkin could give a fuck about clearing the dance floor. Errol would later state that playing a record the audience didn't dig was just confirmation that he wasn't resting on his laurels. He was always pushing, always experimenting. He understood that life wasn't just about success. Life was about being real above all else, and sometimes being real meant screwing up. It may suck in the moment, but it gave context to your truth as an artist. He wasn't about playing it safe. Safe was boring. Errol didn't give a shit about genres. It was music for everyone. This promoter, though, he was proving to be a major downer. The guy didn't understand the alternative culture. How could he? Buttoned up in a suit, just looking for the next buck, punching the clock. And that wasn't what this was all about. This was about the music that ran through Errol's very being. Some of his earliest memories were listening to his parents' record collection, T-Rex, The Stones, The Beatles. And by 12 years old, he was sneaking out of his parents' house to play gigs. And by 20, he was fully immersed in the alternative music movement in England, spending nearly every evening in nightclubs and concert halls from 1991 to 2000. He listened to everything he could get his hands on. DJing was essentially sharing music, and he wanted to make sure he shared the best. Music was all connected. The old informed the new reflected on the old. And there was no reason to draw lines. Regardless, Errol finished his set according to the promoter's rules. He strayed from the songs they didn't want him to play, but he knew when it was over that he was done. Not just at the Dog and Pony Show. He was done playing other people's venues. He wanted to make his own rules for playing to an audience. Just one rule, actually. And that rule was, there were no rules. Total freedom of expression. That rule was in full effect from the first night Errol debuted his own weekly nightclub, Trash, in January 1997. All the way to the night it closed a decade later, that rule stayed in place. Trash took place on Monday nights, not on the weekend, which was also a giant middle finger to the rules, to the way things were usually done. No matter where the club called home, from venues like Plastic People or the Annex in Soho, all the way to The End in London's West End, where it quite literally came to an end in 2007. Trash embodied that one critical rule, no fucking rules. On its first night in 1997, 60 people showed up. Errol knew all of them. No worries, it gave Trash a tight-knit feel. It was more than a club, it was a community. Errol mixed deep cuts and classic tracks with all the independent music that was coming out at the time. It felt new, unexpected, something out of time and space. As dance music began to take on the aesthetics of alternative music throughout the start of the 21st century, the lines between genres continued to blur, and Errol's nightclub blew up. Right place, right time, but also right attitude and right time. At Trash, the subwoofers thumped impossibly loud. The walls vibrated and the foundation shook. Bodies kept coming. Nights that were once averaging 60 guests soon ballooned to 700. All of them packed into the dark, cavernous room with walls painted by a never-ending light show that emanated from the stage. In a typical Errol Alkin set, you could hear Destiny's Child's Bootylicious mixed with Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit, followed by Tom Tom Club's Genius of Love, before transitioning nearly effortlessly into Mary J. Blige's Family Affair. Sets and segues paid no mind to era or genre. If it feels right, do it. It shouldn't have worked, but it did. And Errol oversaw it all, standing at his console with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, pumping his fist along with the crowd. Errol wasn't separate from the audience, and they were all in it together. He was the most sought-after DJ in London, and it made Trash one of the hippest indie clubs in the world. And it wasn't just DJs that got their shot at Trash. Garage Rock Revival and Electro Clash reigned supreme on Trash's stage. The club hosted up-and-coming American indie acts like the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and LCD Sound System, along with UK upstarts like Block Party. The artists would play with the crowd right on top of them, and there were no barricades separating who was on stage from the audience. It was feral, an honest-to-God punk show and procedure, and had the energy to match. Soon, bigger bands dropped off fresh pressings of their latest singles to Errol's turntables. The Verve, The Strokes, The Rapture. Kindred spirits from all corners of the city made the spot their regular hangout, their sanctuary, their source for anything hip and new. And Monday nights were alive with the sound of trash. Amy Winehouse was only 18 when she became a regular devotee. Like so many others, she was drawn to the movement, to the culture, and to the vibe. Amy dug it, the old mixed with the new, the well-known mixed with the unexpected. Trash exposed Amy to new music and new ways of thinking about how music could be made and transmitted, how genres and styles could supersede whatever gimmicky top 40 prepackaged bullshit the record labels were pumping out, as long as the music was good, as long as the music was real. Trash was where Amy gazed into her crystal ball and saw her future. She could be true to herself as an artist, play by her own rules, and be accepted. Not just by a room of trash kids who dressed in vintage thrift store duds and danced to Motorhead's Ace of Spades one moment and ABBA's Dancing Queen the next, but by the world at large, a world that was beginning to embrace the kind of culture clash that trash was promoting. Errol Alkin's Monday Night Dance Club was also where Amy would routinely bump into that skinny guy with the trilby hat, who spent many nights handing out flyers at the front door. The one whose claim to fame before being a flyer hander-outer was working on that one Lily Allen music video. She didn't know what she saw in him, but she saw a future that included him in it, and a relationship with only one rule. No rules at all. Quincy Jones knew a user when he saw one. It wasn't just their appearance, it was more than an unnatural discoloration around the eyes. It was the look in the eyes. Piercing, bottomless, desperate, sketchy. A look that would push a 90-year-old woman out of the way if it meant a direct line to the next fix. Quincy gave off that look more than a few times himself. This was back in the late 40s, early 50s. Ray Charles turned him on to dope when Q was just 15. Quincy was already doing benzos and poppers by that point, and heroin was something else, though. In its own category of high. A high so high that it was low. When Quincy went on tour with Lionel Hampton in the early 1950s, the junkies sat in their own section of the tour bus, and the straights sat up front. Weed smokers behind them, then the boozers, and then the users. Back of the bus with that shit. Seemed like everybody else was using back then. Dealing, too. Hell, every time the tour bus rolled into Detroit, it would make a can't-miss pass by the Majestic Hotel so that the band could buy some dope off Malcolm X. No shit. This was before he was Malcolm X, obviously, and they all called him Detroit Red. Red went to prison for that. Quincy never went to prison for dope, but he did have his own come-to-Jesus moment only 5 months or so into his habit. He was stoned out of his head. He tripped at the top of a staircase, and he fell. 5 flights, tumbling down, head over heels, each stair found a new body part to bruise. And that was it. Quincy Jones didn't fuck with dope anymore after that. But he could still pick out the ones who were fucking with dope from a crowd, even if the crowd was 40,000 strong, like it was on June 27, 2008, at Hyde Park in London. The occasion was Nelson Mandela's 90th birthday party. Queen was on the bill that night, with Bad Company's Paul Rogers attempting to fill Freddie Mercury's immortal shoes. Will Smith, Annie Lennox. The performer that everyone had eyes on that night, however, was Amy Winehouse. Surely, more than a handful of friendly bets were placed as to whether she would pull herself together for long enough to properly honor Nelson Mandela, or if she was once again going to self-destruct on stage. Just 5 months prior, The Sun had leaked that grainy video where she allegedly took hits from a crack pipe. And then there was that dust-up with the guy playing pool at a Camden pub, followed in quick succession with the headbutt she delivered to the bloke who tried to hail her cab. There was Wine Mouse, that strange video co-starring Pete Doherty with cameos from Baby Mice, not to mention the revelation that she had early onset emphysema. And the crowd at Hyde Park braced themselves for the worst. And they were pleasantly surprised when they were given the best. Quincy Jones, like all others in attendance, was duly impressed with Amy's performance. He also saw a look in her eyes when he met her for the first time after the show. That look. She didn't appear high at the time, but the look was right there, lingering, lurking, hanging out at the back of the bus for the next stop to score. Right now, backstage, Amy was charming, nervous too. So nervous that she sent her father Mitch over to broker the introduction. Mitch led Quincy back to where Amy was anxiously waiting. She greeted him like royalty, dropped to her knees, kissed his hand. She rambled on about how she'd been listening to his records her whole life. And not just Michael Jackson's populist bangers, she was down with Ray and Aretha and Count Basie, Dinah Washington, Dizzy, Sarah Vaughan. Quincy was blown away with Amy's knowledge of jazz and R&B. At her age, incredible, he thought. He was so impressed that he invited Amy and Mark Ronson to work on a new project, a tribute album that would honor Quincy himself. Amy couldn't say yes quickly enough. A chance to work with one of her idols. She was in. The project would pair her and Mark with one of the most respected men in the entertainment industry. And there were even rumors circulating that she'd get the opportunity to perform tracks from the album live with none other than Michael Jackson. Amy wanted to cover some old Leslie Gore, one of the iconic songs Quincy had helmed back in the early 60s. You Don't Own Me, or Maybe It's My Party. They both gave off huge Amy Winehouse vibes. It was a massive opportunity. Who knew what else it would lead to? If there was a reason for Amy to hold it together, this was it. She managed to hold it together for a little under 2 weeks. At her next show in Glastonbury, she punched a fan in the face. A month after that, she pulled out of the Rock on Seine Festival for the second straight year. A week after that, she showed up to Bestival 40 minutes late, hammered. Close to a year later, Quincy Jones was still looking for the song Amy had promised. Quincy knew Amy was a once-in-a-lifetime talent, and that's why he gave her so much time to turn the track in. Mark Ronson, meanwhile, was standing by, ready to finish the tune. They were so close, it wouldn't take much time at all. It didn't matter. Amy was in St. Lucia or wherever and obviously had other priorities. The track was never delivered. Quincy Jones noted the user behavior. 1 minute they were in, the next minute they were out, dropped out, hard. And so, in turn, Quincy dropped her from his album. Amy stewed in private. She was pissed at Quincy Jones for not giving her more time. Pissed that he thought she was a strung-out junkie even though she was making a concerted effort to get herself off dope once and for all. She was also pissed at herself for taking so long to turn something in. And that was on her. And she was pissed at Mark Ronson because of how disappointed he was. The whole thing ate away at her for a long time, until one morning she took all her anger out on a computer keyboard. September 18th, 2010, 5:16 a.m. The sun was starting to rise, but the dull glow cast on Amy Winehouse's face was coming from her laptop. She was fuming. She'd just seen the interview Mark Ronson gave to Jules Holland. He took credit for the work she did. She wrote that album. It was her emotion that she had put into words, her heartbreak. And he had the nerve to say she stumbled into the studio with an acoustic guitar, plucked a few strings like some remedial bimbo, and he did the rest. Bullshit. She made him, not the other way around. If it wasn't for her, he'd be stuck in DJ booth purgatory for the rest of his life. She rubbed her eyes, and she was beat. Maybe she should just go to bed. Fuck it. She opened her browser and pulled up Twitter. She was using her burner account, @AmyJadeMermaid, but there was nothing anonymous about it. Her 40,000 followers knew it was her. Good. She wanted everyone to know. This prick with the slick back pompadour wasn't going to pull one over on her. Nobody was. She began to type. Ronson, you're dead to me. One album I write and you take half the credit. Make a career out of it. I don't think so, bruv. She sat on it for a day, and then another. And the tabloids took her missive to the next level. Amy Winehouse starts feud with collaborator Mark Ronson on Twitter, read the headline of the Daily Mail. Mark appeared on the morning TV show BBC Breakfast to admit that he wasn't sure what he'd done to upset her. He even went as far as to say that Amy was the reason he was on the map, and why would he try to take credit for her hard work? On the third day, Amy sat back down at her laptop and composed a follow-up tweet. Ronson, I love you. That make it better? You know I love you. She regretted what she had said, just like she regretted what she had done with the song for Quincy Jones, or rather what she hadn't done with that song. At least she didn't make Mark Ronson wait a year for an apology. Quincy Jones never got his. He was still waiting. Not that she dissed Quincy Jones. In her mind, she just had a change of heart. It was her track. She'd sing it if she wanted to. She knew there would be more opportunities, including one so lucrative it would be damn near impossible to pass up.
We'll be right back after this word.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
December 2010. The wheels of the impressive private jet touched down in snowy Moscow. The opulence Amy Winehouse was treating to was stunningly over the top. Crystal hung from the ceilings and gold plating radiated in the bathrooms. The furniture screamed House of Romanov, even though it looked like it hadn't been sat on in centuries, maybe ever. The hotel room alone was worth £1,700 a night. She didn't mind that the man paying for it all wanted to remain anonymous. Nor did she mind that the same man had assigned a staggering 50 bodyguards to escort her to and from the show. That's after flying her from London to Moscow for his private one-off gig. She also didn't mind what his politics were or what he thought about anything, really. £1 million meant that she didn't have to mind. £1 million for a 40-minute set performed at the request of a billionaire Russian oligarch. That's £25,000 a minute. The oligarch got to handpick the set list, and that seemed only fair. The way he treated Amy before she even put a microphone to her mouth, well, that was more than fair. That was red carpet,
she felt like a queen. Amy had played a similar show 2 years prior when a Chelsea football club owner paid her £1.5 million to perform at his girlfriend's art gallery. And that gig also happened to be in Moscow, but it did not go as planned. She took the stage 2 hours late, drunk or high or both, she couldn't remember which, and managed to inform the audience that she had also arrived commando, which she did by hiking up her dress. But that seemed like forever ago at this point. At the same time, it also seemed like it hadn't been that long ago at all. Probably because in the time since, Amy hadn't completed a full concert. It was all she could think about as she took the stage on the top floor of a Moscow shopping center. It was closed off to the public. Again, more opulence. Dresses and gowns and suits that probably cost as much as they were paying her. She walked out in a tight leopard print dress to deafening applause. Her mind raced. And the last time she took a stage was 8 months ago, the St. Lucia Jazz Festival. Everyone knew how that turned out. And the haves here in Moscow weren't placing friendly bets on whether the show that night would be good or bad. It would be good. It had to be good. Amy's heart beat faster. Fuck. What if she couldn't do this? What if she couldn't keep it together? What if she bombed? What if it was worse than the last private Moscow gig? And that would be worse than bad. Would the rich Russian guy take the money back? Would he ding her £1,000 for each flubbed line like James Brown did back in the day? The faces in the crowd went gooey, women's eyes like dartboards, their eyeshadow a succession of increasingly severe concentric circles, and the circles rotated like hands around a clock. Amy didn't dare stare at them too long for fear that she'd be hypnotized. Or maybe this was all a ruse. It was some Bond villain plot to get her locked in a private room. And for what? She had no idea. She didn't speak Russian. They could do whatever they wanted to her and no one would ever know. And the 50 bodyguards standing in a perimeter around the room would make sure of that. She stepped up to the microphone and cracked a joke, lightened things up. But no one laughed. And they probably didn't even understand what she had said. They all just sat there, mouths agape. The lights caught their gaudy jewelry, flashes of silver and diamond and pearl shone in Amy's eyes and caused her to stumble a bit to the side. The band began to play, and the song was familiar. Amy knew that she knew it, and she fell into the rhythm, found her place. The microphone beckoned her to step forward, and she did. And then, she opened her mouth to sing. Amy was already a few drinks deep when her father, Mitch, got to her. It was early in the morning, probably too early for a drink, let alone two. It was February 2011. Amy was thinking of Ronnie Wood and a warmer environment, like Brazil. Ronnie Wood and Brazil went hand in hand. She was there in January for the Summer Soul Festival, and Ronnie was there too, same hotel. The Rolling Stones guitarist was 10 months sober at the time. Everyone knew that a life spent as a Rolling Stone was a life lived harder than most. So to be 10 months sober, well, that was like a decade sober in non-Rolling Stones years. Ronnie had seen many friends come and go over the years, many of them gone to that place of no return, gone forever. He saw firsthand what excess and excessive accolades could do, not just to a person's music, but to a person. Some emerged from the wreckage with scars and stories to tell. Others just succumbed to the undertow. Ronnie and Amy took a walk through the gardens, and Ronnie imparted what advice he could without sounding too much like a fucking after-school special. It was hard to fly straight. It was a little easier in a place like Brazil. The weather was divine. London, on the other hand, was dank and dark. At least it wasn't as cold as Moscow had been. She had left Moscow, riding high on her own talent. Moscow felt like a dream. She pulled that performance out like a rabbit from a hat, £25,000 a minute, and she delivered every minute like a goddamn pro. Rode that positive momentum on the plane all the way back home. Went to Brazil, still positive, and even got the positive pep talk from Ronnie. But Ronnie wasn't with her now in London, and neither was the nice weather or the £1 million payday. Her father, Mitch, was understandably concerned. She saw that look in his face. Her daddy didn't think she was fine. She knew what would happen next. She'd go to Dubai for her next scheduled show. She wouldn't be able to use the weather as an excuse anymore because it was hot there, like desert hot, and she'd still be drinking.
Somebody, whether it was her father or a record company or her management, would install a 24/7 surveillance unit again like they had before outside her hotel room. And maybe she'd know their names, maybe not. And they would operate under strict instructions that no contraband could go in or out, and keep her dry and get her up, get her to the show, get her on the stage, get her back to the hotel, and get her home. The Dubai show would be another disaster. The people would turn on her again. Or maybe they had never really been on her side in the first place. They walked down the streets of balmy London hand in hand. It was 4 a.m, and a long Saturday night was slowly turning into an early warm Sunday morning. They had broken up a month ago. She accused him of cheating. He begged forgiveness and was all forgiven, at the very least, here on Great Queen Street with the sun yet to rise. All had been forgotten. They had been madly in love before, and maybe they could be again. The neon sign for the Red Rooms, a gentleman's club, buzzed overhead. Inside, it was still the night before, and morning would never come. She nodded towards the front door, and then she smiled. They both entered. When they exited the club a short time after, morning had broken. But word had broken, too, that he was there, at the Red Rooms, with her. And they both lit up a cigarette and began to walk down the street. Paparazzi were stationed outside the club, waiting in the tall grass, ready to launch their ambush. He managed to catch a glimpse of a man with a camera off to the side right at the moment when he grabbed her hand. Shit. He tried to disappear, to run, to dive out of the way. He had to do something. He could not be seen with her. He wasn't fast enough. The cameras got what they came for. Money shots galore. He should have known. Should have seen them coming. He could never be too careful. This was just careless. Reg Travis, Amy Winehouse's current flame, had been caught red-handed. Photographed with his ex-girlfriend, a burlesque dancer no less, after a long night out on the town, in and out of a strip joint even, and just a month after Amy had given Reg an ultimatum. He could cut all ties with his ex or he would lose Amy. And this is the same ex who had sold tawdry stories about Amy to the tabloids. The fuck? Amy looked over the pictures in the Daily Mail the next day. No way. No chance. Here he was, her boyfriend, allegedly, walking down the street hand in hand with his ex at 4 a.m. It had been nearly a year since Amy's very public divorce from Blake Fielder Civil, and 6 months since her last public meltdown. Reg was aware of all she had gone through, and what she was still going through, and that's what made it hurt more. Amy had finally allowed herself to feel vulnerable. She opened herself up to Reg. He grounded her and gave her the space and support to get her shit together. She was truly moving on from Blake and starting a new chapter in her life. Sobriety was at the end of the tunnel, not just the Class A shit, but alcohol too. Amy had been laying low, keeping out of the spotlight, keeping her head on straight, much to the chagrin of the vultures in the media, of course. But here was this. A piece of news, a bit of gossip, something to throw on the front page, get people talking, a few quick photos that equaled a solid payday, and that's what the media saw it as. Amy, however, saw it as a shattering betrayal. Reg had told Amy that he had broken it off with that girl and that it was over, and he was with Amy now. But the ex was telling the papers the opposite. According to her, she had continued her romance with Reg throughout the better part of Reg and Amy's 4-month relationship. According to her, Reg came crawling back, and he groveled. He was ending it with Amy. Amy meant nothing to him. Amy was confused. They had talked about marriage. They talked about kids, about settling down for real. She didn't know who or what to believe anymore. Over the next few weeks, Reg would avoid Amy when he saw her out at the pub. He failed to show up at her brother's engagement party. He even skipped out on the Libertines concert they had planned to attend together months ago. And just months ago, Amy had been the other woman. And now the tables had tragically turned. The stars were crossed up in the sky, and down here on the ground, the universe had dealt yet another shitty hand. There was only one rule in this life, and that rule was that there were no rules. None at all. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. The 27 Club is hosted and produced by me, Jake Brennan, for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Seth Lundy is the lead writer and co-producer. This episode was mixed by Matt Bowden. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker and Henry Lunetta. This episode was written by Ted Omo. Story and copy editing by Pat Healy. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. Talk to me on social at Disgraceland Pod and hang out with me live on my Twitch channel, Disgraceland Talks. For more news on your favorite podcast, follow at Double Elvis on Instagram. Rock-a-rolla.
What's up for your ears?
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.